you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 125. That's 125 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyree, your host, as usual. Today, I have a tremendous guest. I'm very happy to have Allison Williams from Short Hills, New Jersey, on as my guest. Allison, you know, it kind of breaks the mold a little bit here in terms of the typical guest that we have, because I would say she's far from a solo or small firm practitioner. She started off that way, but she's now built her matrimonial and child welfare practice to be a powerhouse in the state of New Jersey and a model for similar type firms around the country. So much so that she also has segued or branched out to being a coach for attorneys who want to achieve the same type of growth and success that she has over the course of a few short years in her practice. So it's a really interesting conversation that I had with her. We talk a lot about the mindset and how she went about developing her firm. And then we branch out to her coaching business. So to me, it's a very interesting interview. I hope you get as much out of it as I did. And so without any further delay, here's my friend Allison Williams. Allison Williams, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you for having me, Neil. I'm excited to be here.
Well, I'm delighted that you're here. I've been hoping to have you on the program for some time. I'm glad we were finally able to get our calendars to mesh and our technology to work properly. Allison, tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Sure. So I am the owner of the Williams Law Group. We are a family law firm located in Short Hills, New Jersey, which is in the northern part of the state. And what makes us unique is that we have a division of the firm devoted solely to the representation of parents and families involved in the child welfare system. So for anyone that's familiar with that practice area, you know that the vast majority of people that do that work get that work assigned through the public defender's office, or they are employed by the public defender's office. We are not. We are solely in the private sector. So of the 98% of cases that are handled by the public defender's office in court, we handle the other 2%. And we have a couple of other people that kind of dabble in that market space, but we really dominate the market there. So that's my practice in a nutshell. I've been a family law attorney my entire career. I'm a fellow of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, certified by the Supreme Court of New Jersey as a matrimonial law attorney, and really found my passion for child welfare law early on in my career and have been pursuing that really for about 12 years now.
What's the discriminator as to why a client would either go with a public defender or in this case, a private counsel? Is it the same as in other criminal matters that they either don't qualify or they prefer the private attorney over a public defender?
So we actually do represent quite a few people that do qualify for the public defender's office. But the reason why people choose us is that we have created a unique way of handling these cases. It's very different than what you get with the public defender's office. So, of course, as with any area that is overwhelmingly glutted with people that are in the lower economic strata of society, there's a high volume of cases that are assigned to each attorney in the public defender's office. So usually you're getting touch points at court, you're getting preparation for trial, but you're not getting much else. Mm-hmm. And we treat our child abuse cases just like we treat our matrimonial cases. So we come in, we don't reactively wait for the state to tell us what they want. We ask for what we want. We file applications to get that. We're very aggressive in litigating. And so you're more likely to get a better outcome when someone is proactively asserting your position. but you're also more likely to get those touch points that make it better for you through the process. So we're very hands-on in guiding our clients through using the proper services to be reunified with their children, to dealing with whatever issues they have, may, you know, be they substance abuse, mental health, any types of domestic violence, any types of problems that are coming up. We're on top of those problems, and we're helping you manage those problems while we're also helping you defend yourself in court, which is very different than the experience you get with a public defender.
Yeah. And, you know, just to be balanced, we're not throwing shade at the public defenders because you know, they are extraordinarily overworked and do, you know, a tremendous value for the public. But it's just a factual matter with that kind of caseload and the resources that the public defender's office has, it's very difficult for them to provide the same type and quality of service as a private attorney can under those circumstances. So,
yeah, I definitely echo those sentiments, Neil. I don't in any way mean to demean the public defender's office. In fact, some of our best referrals come from the public defender's office, but it really is just, like you said, a matter of volume. You know, if you're handling 200 cases, and you're in court 5 days a week, there really is not time to be on the phone with people and actively involved in their day-to-day and staying on top of calendaring their services and things like that. So, you know, they do the best that they can with what they're given, and they're often very, very dedicated, hardworking attorneys. They just, you know, there's only so many hours to go around, but since we are being paid a standard attorney rate for the work that we do, we can devote more time to it because it's the same type of service as any other family law service.
Sure. So take us back to the dark ages, you know, law school. Did you know at that time that you wanted to pursue a solo or small firm career, or did you see yourself in big law, or what were your aspirations and how did they change over time?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting question, and I want to thank you for asking me that. I did not in any way want to be a solo. In fact, I very much wanted to be a big law attorney because I saw what I think most people see of the profession, or at least back when I was coming up. You know, you see the big, beautiful buildings, and you see the brass handles and the glass doors, and you see people catering to you, and you have this status, and you have this money. And I think that's what people think of when they think of lawyers. But the reality of lawyering is very different. And so when I started my career, I had that aspiration. I wanted to be at the large law firm. I wanted to have my name on a door. And I was very much driven by ego. And then I started doing the work. I fell into practicing family law and started doing the work. And I saw that really you weren't getting better service out of a larger law firm because they were smarter. You were getting better service because they had more procedures and systems wrapped around them. And I just didn't see that with solo law firms. So when I ultimately decided in 2012 that I was going to leave my law firm and start a solo practice, my biggest concern was whether or not I would be able to give the highest level of service to my clients and whether my reputation would decline because I would now not have all of the wraparound services, the paralegals, the, you know, the file clerks, the runners, the, you know, lunch delivered for me every day. I wouldn't have those things anymore. And what I ultimately learned through the course of running a law firm was you can have those things. You have to just create them in a very different way than you create them in a large law firm because you can't just buy a solution every time you have a problem.
Right. So there had to be some genesis, some spark that said, you know, I'm here in big law, but I really want to be over there. I think I can do it. I think I can be a solo. What prompted that? Is there a solo entrepreneurship in your family history, or was there a colleague that you saw that you envied and said, I could do the same thing? I mean, what finally got you to step off that plank?
Well, I wish I could say that I was inspired by a great solo attorney or even in my own family, but it was neither of those things. It was solely my ego.
That's fair.
You know, I'm going to be completely honest with you because that's just how I roll. You know, when I became an attorney, I had to learn how to be a good attorney. And when I got to that place of knowing what I was doing, I had fallen in love with the child welfare practice. And I saw someone that was just a good human being that fell on their laurels when their spouse committed suicide. Ooh. And this person became very severely depressed, involved in the child welfare system, rightfully so. The kids they should have been taken out of the environment because it was gross neglect. But the system kind of ran roughshod over her and they didn't concern themselves with her. And I was very offended by that. So I threw myself passionately into learning, breathing, eating, sleeping the law. 90-hour weeks to learn how to be a child welfare attorney. And when I became an expert at it, I started to monetize it. And so I started lecturing. I started publishing. Any person that encountered me knew that that was what I do and what I was passionate about. And over a relatively short period of time, from 2007 to about 2010, that became a multi-six-figure practice without any paid advertising, without any infrastructure. Just me and my big mouth generated a few hundred thousand dollars. So in 2012, by that time, it was about a $400,000 revenue stream. And it was growing rapidly, and I couldn't keep pace with the work because I was covering it all over the state of New Jersey. So I could be in the car 4 hours in a day.
Right.
And I said, you know, I need help. So I went to the partner I worked with and I said, you know, we need an associate. And he agreed. And I said, all right, I'm willing to train the associate, put the systems in place, get them to understand the practice. But in the meantime, I'm not doing that as your associate. So you need to give me a title. And frankly, having a statewide reputation, judges were calling me for advice on how to handle these issues. Politicians were referring me clients. I didn't really understand how I could possibly have the title of associate. So I approached him and I said, listen, you know, this is something that you need to fix. And when the initial conversation started, partner I spoke to was very much on board. He had to go to the other partners. And after he did so, he came back and was hedging and saying, well, you know, we need to think about this. We need to talk about this. And I said, you know what? I'm done. You know, thank you, and I'm out.
So that was the push. It wasn't so necessarily a step, but it might have been a step and a push at the same time.
Yeah, it was. I had some personal challenges, and I had overcome them, and I kind of felt like now I believe in myself, and now I'm really to go willing to go take this and run with it and get a very small piece of it. I wasn't even looking for more money. But if you're not willing to recognize that for the value that it is, you know, right. I'm not staying for this anymore.
Well, I appreciate your honesty there because, you know, a lot of times the folks that we have on the show, they don't come from that same perspective. There's a lot of reasons to go solo. There's a lot of reasons maybe to leave a mid to size or large firm. But I think it's very honest of you to say, look, I was bringing in a lot of business, a lot of revenue to this firm and really it should be recognized for what it is. And if you're not going to do so, you know, I've now convinced myself and I'm sure that I can do this on my own because I'm doing it very successfully here. So that's great to hear. So you didn't have a whole lot of concerns then when you did step off that plank and decide to go solo. You weren't concerned that you were going to have difficulty finding clients or creating a business model.
Yeah, I was not afraid about clients in the traditional sense. I mean, I think there's anytime you step out, I haven't heard any lawyer that started a firm that didn't say the, oh my God, what if the phone stops ringing, right? Yeah. That fear, I think, is visceral.
Yeah.
But by the time that I left, you know, I was very blessed that the very first large firm that I worked at, you know, it was a business firm. So every month I was expected to bill a certain number of hours, collect a certain number of dollars, and generate a certain number of dollars. And so I was always looking at what I was bringing into the business. And I was always fixated on what can I do to get more clients in the door? What can I do to collect more of my money? How can I bill more hours efficiently? So that was just my orientation by the time I was a lawyer. So I wasn't really concerned about, you know, feeding myself. I knew how much was coming in. I knew how much I was earning. I was going to get a pay raise just by virtue of owning it myself.
Right.
The real fear for me was how the heck am I going to put all that other stuff in place? And I really didn't honestly think about it anywhere near as much as I should have. So
right.
I wasn't thinking about how much time it takes to negotiate the leases and sign the contract and order the paper supplies and hire the people and create the systems and, you know, fix things when they go wrong and get an IT person. Like, none of that stuff was in my realm of thinking. So I had my 43 clients. I was servicing 48 clients when I was at my law firm. 43 of them came with me when I left. The five that left behind, they left behind because I chose not to bring them with me because their cases were almost over.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so having 43 clients, you think, wow, that's great. You've got a stream of revenue of 43 clients. But the problem was that, you know, I didn't have a competent secretary when I started. So I was trying to figure out how to be a secretary around being a lawyer. I was also, you know, I had my secretary at my old office. She was going to come with me. She backed out at the last minute. So I was kind of left in a lurch, if you will.
Right.
Then my uncle died in the first 2 weeks that I started my practice. So I had to fly off to Florida in the midst of the chaos that was starting my law firm. So a lot was going on.
It's a different kind of, you know, impact. You know, when you bring 40 plus clients with you across the transom, but you don't have any of the support network or any of the resources that you had previously. Now you got a different problem. It's not so much, I can worry about bringing in new clients in a little bit. My biggest problem is, how do I service my existing clients and get this whole thing up and running at the same time? You know, this is a different challenge.
Yeah. And it was definitely a different challenge. And I did some pretty stupid stuff. I mean, I look back now and I think, God, I'm lucky to be alive.
Yeah. How so?
The first thing was, like I said, I had never hired a secretary before, yeah, and I'd never been without a really competent secretary. So when I had to go hire somebody, you know, I think I did what most lawyers do. You know, you write a job ad that says name, rank, and serial number. Here's what I need. You give a salary range. The people come in, you interview them. If you like them, you hire them, after you check some references. And, you know, I did that 3 times. And by number 3, I said, you know what, I'm just attracting the most incompetent human beings on the face of the earth. So, you know what, I'm done with that. I'll be my own secretary. So I lived about 45 minutes from the office. And I would get up in the morning, drive my 45 minutes to work, be a secretary from 6 a.m. to 8:30 in the morning, a lawyer from 8:30 to 6. 6 to 7, I would take my, quote, dinner break. And that was usually to return all the emails that came in throughout the day. And then from 7 to 9, I'd be a secretary again. And then I'd drive 45 minutes home and rinse and repeat 7 days a week.
Well, you know, what somebody told me once when I went solo, that it's great, you only have to work half time now. And the challenge is deciding which 12 hours of the day you're gonna work.
Yeah, exactly, right? So after about 3.5 weeks of that grueling schedule, I was so exhausted that I decided I was going to cut out early one day on a Thursday, and I didn't have court the next day by some miracle. So I was like, great, I'm going to leave at 8 instead of 9, and I'm going to sleep until 5 instead of 4. And I was so proud of myself to give myself that time. And I got in the car and I'm driving 90 miles an hour down the parkway so I can get home. And then I woke up and I'm still driving 90 miles an hour and I'm 1/4 centimeter away from a guardrail. Mm. So when that happened, you know, I kind of pulled over, got myself together, had my freak out moment, said a few expletives at God and said, you know, what the F, you know, yeah. Why is this happening to me? I'm a hardworking person. Why can't I find the stuff I needed? So I actually then went to sell myself back to a large law firm. And luckily I had the connections. I could just call up people and say, you know, hey, do you want me? I'm bringing at that time, $600,000 with me. You know, I got one associate. We'll work our asses off. Please say yes. And I got the yes. And I was about to go get the offer when I ultimately pulled over again on the side of the road and said, something's telling me I need not to do this. So again, I believe it was divine intervention. And I decided I was going to keep the firm. But at that point, I said, I got to fix it. It's going to kill me if I don't get a handle on it. And that's when I started working with business coaches to really dial in what it is that I needed to do to make it less chaotic. And, you know, in a relatively short period of time, it was hard work, but, you know, I got it to the place where it wasn't just stable. It was stable and growing rapidly.
So you started working with a business coach or business coaches. Were they in the legal space specifically or just generalized business and entrepreneurial advocates?
So there were a few. The first mm-hmm. company I started working with was a company based out of Florida called How to Manage a Small Law Firm. So there I had people that were trained on giving advice about business to lawyers and only to lawyers.
Sure.
From there, I started working with a wealth coach named David Nagel. And David is really a coach of other coaches. However, he has started over the years to work more and more with business owners, entrepreneurs, and lawyers. And so he really helped me to frame how my thoughts about problems were really causing the problems and not necessarily the problem itself. So give you an example, you know, if you look at your bank account and you've got 20% of what you need to make payroll by the end of the next week, you've got some time, but you also have some urgency. So you're thinking, okay, how do I make sure I get the dollars in? Money doesn't just fall from the trees. Where is it going to come from? Most people, if they go into panic mode, would shut down and then start saying, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, I've got to go out and take credit. I've got to not take a paycheck this week. And you kind of get that fervor of solving the problem by taking from yourself, as opposed to solving the problem by looking at the solutions. And really, when you start thinking about the solutions more than the problems solve themselves relatively easy. And so David really helped me to just get emotionally well with the stress of owning a law firm. And that gave me the space to be creative and to start thinking about innovative ways to grow the firm and get the right people on the team and create the system so that the firm could not just do well, but do well and really be an industry leader, which is what I always wanted.
So with the assistance of these coaches and hard work, you're able to get the lease negotiated, buy the furniture, get the computers and set up and the support and start to add staff. You started with the legal secretary?
I did. I finally hired somebody who knew how to be a legal secretary.
Okay.
And then I hired my first associate and then my second. So by 2014, less than a year into the business, we kind of got to the five-man dream team of me, two associates, and two staff people.
And that's where you're at now?
No. We've scaled quite a bit. So over a 4-year time period after I owned the firm, we grew our revenues 856%. And so, of course, with that, you needed all the infrastructure to support that. So now there's a team of 17 of us comprised of myself. I have 6 attorneys on the team, including 1 counsel, 2 senior associates, 3 associates. I have 2 paralegals and a paralegal assistant, a receptionist, an office administrator. We have a full built out marketing and sales team, as well as an intake department, and we have interns. So there's 17 on the team right now. We have 2 lawyers that are joining the firm next month. I anticipate adding another paralegal probably within a month or 2 after that. And, you know, we're still in growth mode. We're not in rapid growth mode anymore because I've now devoted some of my attention over to building out the coaching business that I created to help lawyers do the same thing I did.
This episode of The Law Entrepreneur is sponsored by Daylight. Daylight is the Mac CRM and case management tool I've been using for years to manage my practice. If you're feeling swamped trying to keep track of cases and clients, but you don't want to pay the hefty price tag of something like Salesforce or other legal-specific tools, I recommend you give Daylight a look. Daylight helps me prioritize my day. It helps me keep track of my clients, cases, documents, emails, calendars, to-dos, and reminders, all in one place. The case management part of Daylight makes it really easy to organize all the details and work for each case so things are done on time. The best part of Daylight is that it lets you work offline. You don't need an internet connection to pull up case details or info about a client like with other CRMs and case management tools. And new in Daylight is their Zapier integration, so you can automate things like pulling new leads from a contact form on your website right into Daylight. And for techies like me, you know that integration with tools like Zapier is really fundamental to making something like Daylight work the way you want it to work. So to learn how Daylight can help you grow your practice, visit marketcircle.com/daylight. Be sure to let them know you heard about Daylight through The Law Entrepreneur to get a 50% discount on your first month subscription. That's Daylight by Market Circle. The legal environment is more competitive than ever, and small law firms are feeling the pinch. With over 1.3 million attorneys in the United States and counting, it can be hard to stand out from the crowd. And that's why Spotlight Branding helps lawyers become unforgettable. Spotlight Branding is a different kind of internet marketing company. They don't put their clients on the SEO hamster wheel, and they don't ask them to burn thousands of dollars on speculative pay-per-click advertising. Instead, they're focused on the fundamentals of legal marketing that have worked for dozens upon dozens of years. They use the internet to build a premium brand for solo and small firm lawyers like myself, and they put systems in place to create top-of-mind awareness, allowing their clients to maximize the referrals and repeat business. It's the smart way to grow your law firm. To get more information, visit spotlightbranding.com/TLE, as in The Law Entrepreneur, and receive a special gift from our friends there at Spotlight Branding. Spotlight Branding, helping lawyers become unforgettable. So what's the key then in terms of being able to manage staff as you go through that rapid expansion, you know, acquire good help, fund their acquisitions, provide for their nurturing, care and nurturing? What's the key in your mind to developing good staff?
Well, the key to developing good staff varies depending on who they are. But, you know, it always, in my view, it starts from the idea of understanding them as a person. So now, anytime I hire somebody, we use a tool called the Real Talent Hiring MRI, which is an assessment tool that you can get from realtalenthiring.com. I don't get a promo for promoting this at all. I just believe in it 1,000%. You have somebody take this test and they give you a report on how the person manages tasks, themselves, and others. And when you understand that about a person, you can start to look for limitations in the way that they do things so that you can start planning around them. So if you see that you hired somebody with low self-esteem, that might be fine if you're looking at a paralegal, right? Because the paralegal is facilitating the work of the lawyer. But if you're looking at a lawyer who's going to be an aggressive litigator, having low self-esteem might limit their ability to take aggressive positions, to speak back to a judge who's demeaning to them, who's incapable of advising a client about things that are hard for the client to hear. So you wouldn't necessarily say no to that person, but you really want to test what it is about them that is going to make them a part of your team and effective in the role. And then once they get here, when they start to have challenges, because we all have challenges as human beings, you can really approach it from the perspective of what is it about the way that this person does things in general that I can help relate to them, the problem that they're creating or that they are exacerbating. What can I say about that problem in a way that they will get the message, they will attune to it, and they can start to either work around it or solve it as a general construction? And that has helped not only to get better people on the team, but also to get them optimized in the role that they have in the firm.
So you're a strong advocate of using these types of, not necessarily, would you call them a personality tool? Because I know there's things like DISCUS is one, and there's Myers-Briggs, and you know, a bunch of these things that give you insight into a person's kind of views and mental structure. You're a strong advocate of that on the hiring end. Do you also use that in terms of development and staff management?
Well, absolutely, I use them. I'm a big advocate of the Real Talent Hiring MRI for making sure that you get the right people in. But some of the others that you mentioned, like the DISC, you know, some of the others have the ability to transmute over time. So you have to be very careful about that because, you know, like for instance, I've taken the DISC now 3 different times.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm a DI. Like when I was in litigation mode, I was very high DI because I had to be persuasive. So I was persuading on a daily basis. That became my mode of being. Now that I own a law firm, I'm still a D because that's my personality, but I'm a DC. So I'm much more conscientious, concerned about, you know, risks and evaluating risk and reward, structure, things like that. So you have to be careful about which ones you use, but there are some tests that are much better at helping you build culture. So in my office, we use the core values index, and we actually hired an outside consultant to come in, administer the test, and help us understand how the results of the people on the team were going to impact the way that we could get things done. So things like that help you to not just for yourself, but also for your team to really understand what it is about the company that is going to motivate and help them achieve their goals. Because at the end of the day, that's what everybody's concerned about. What's in it for me? And if you don't approach it from that perspective, then you're building what you want. And if the person fits what you want, great. And if they don't, they don't. And you've just lost a lot of money hiring, training, optimizing somebody who really wasn't fit for where you want to go.
I'll admit my own shortcomings here. I've not been completely convinced of the utility of these types of tools. But having said that, every successful attorney that I talk to, I mean, really successful attorney like yourself, are completely devoted to them. And I've had a couple of people on the show whose business is centered around, you know, providing those tools and resources and analysis to law firms. So, you know, I recognize it works for a lot of folks. Maybe it's my own shortcoming that I just feel that I end up answering the questions aspirationally, what I would like to be as opposed to what I think I really am. And therefore, I don't know that it gives an accurate reading, you know?
Yeah, it depends on which kind of test that you take. Uh-huh. So there are definitely tests that will ask you to choose among multiple choices for what you would want to do or what you would do in a situation. And those are harder for you to get a good read on because, yeah, you're right. Some people just naturally fake good. You know, they really want to show up in a positive way. So they say, oh, yes, I'm always fair. I'm always courteous and whatnot. The Real Talent Hiring MRI is not a questionnaire. It's a tool where you put things in order based on your value system. Mm-hmm. And the core values index is very much the same. You evaluate different descriptors based on your value system. So it's possible that you could say, I really want to say that I value world peace over, you know, over eating a nice meal, right? You could say one is more important than the other based on what you think you're supposed to say. But the problem is, or really the way around that is that if you do that exercise multiple times, it's very hard for you to normatively change the way that you think about things consistently across the various different domains. So when you do the same exercise multiple times, if you're faking it, the way that you fake it is going to come out at some point. And that's why you have these tests that have validity and reliability scales so that they can kind of catch that.
Oh,
and then, of course, you know, if the results are not consistent with what you're showing up in person, if somebody, I've had people evaluate my test scores and say, wow, based on your test scores, I'd really expect you to be like this, but your staff is telling me you're like that. That usually means that you've either done a lot of coaching or personal development work, a lot of therapy, things that would help to moderate your weaknesses and accelerate your strengths. So you may not necessarily show up in life the way that your test results would suggest, but it's more likely than not that that's where you're going to get to if you're stressed or if you're just reacting. You're going to react consistent with your test scores if you're taking the right kind of test.
Do you, at this point with the development of your firm, do you still spend as much time speaking, lecturing, traveling, advocating on behalf of the practice area as opposed to your firm specifically? Or is that something that, given the size that you're at now, you no longer need to spend as much time doing?
So family law and child abuse and neglect law are my passions. So I very much still am dedicated to public awareness, if for nothing else other than the fact that I truly believe that the law deserves and people deserve to have lawyers that know what they're doing with this practice area. So even if you're not going to refer me your case because it's too complex for you to handle, you can still do a better job serving a member of our society and helping a family separate and apart from my economic interest in that. So I still want to share that message. Mm-hmm. I lecture very frequently, usually on average once every couple of months now in some area of family law. And I still publish frequently. Next year, I'm going to be at the International Association of Law and Mental Health in Rome. We're talking about child sexual abuse. So it's still a very much a part of my career trajectory that I be out there. It is less so a part of our marketing plan now because I have saturated the market in New Jersey. While I'm certainly, there's always the opportunity to get the next client. Most people that know child abuse in New Jersey or have that issue, if you just Google, you're going to find my name. So. Yeah. I don't necessarily need to do it in order to generate revenue now. Now it's much more about getting my foot soldiers out there and helping them to advance their careers and get more clients in the door by virtue of promoting them.
And just to complete the picture then, what role does technology play in your firm and what type of technology do you use?
So we use a lot of technology. And in fact, I can't promote enough the fact that technology is the second most important thing in your law firm. You know, people are number one. You get the wrong people, you're going to tank your business. You get the right people, you're going to accelerate your business. That's just reality. But technology is a very, very close second. We change technology often. Right now, we're actually in the process of converting over to a practice management software called Leap, L-E-A-P as in Paul. And from what we've seen of it, we haven't used it yet, but we've heard nothing but exceptional things about it. And the fact that a lot of things are automated. So as soon as you pull up a letter to draft, you draft that letter, it shows up on your letterhead. It's automatically saved as a PDF. It's automatically emailed to a client as soon as you click send. You can transmit by your adversaries. Everything's pulled from an intake form that's created at the beginning. Your billing starts as soon as you start the task. So the billing is captured automatically. And a lot of that type of automation in practice makes things faster and more efficient. So if you want to work fewer hours, you don't have to compromise on the dollars you generate. If you want to generate more dollars, you can work the same number of hours and accomplish two times as much. So that is very much a part of our model. Worst technology mm-hmm. I've ever used, by the way, is Time Matters. And, you know, LexisNexis, you know, God
gotcha.
Love you.
Gotcha.
You know, we love Lexis as a research tool, but right. I'm using technology now. Time Matters is what we're getting out of. And it's not cloud-based. I think anyone that's not using cloud-based right now is really limiting their practice, but it's not cloud-based.
To that point, how much is mobile computing playing a role in your firm?
Well, you know, the beauty of what we have now is just about everything is mobile accessible. Part of the reason why we're moving off of Time Matters is, again, because I want everything in the cloud. Right. But so we have Vertical Viewpoint is our phone system, and you can access that by app. So if you're out of the office, you can call through the app and people see it coming up as the telephone number for the office, not your personal cell phone number. You know, of course, email is accessible on devices. I give all of my attorneys a mobile device so that they can communicate with the office and clients out of the office. And for me personally, I haven't gotten my team onto this. So to some degree, I've let my attorneys be very involved in what technology we choose because, you know, I want them to use it. And if they're not using it, but I love it, that's not helpful. But I personally am a big advocate of the iPad because when I was an associate at a law firm before I started my practice from 2009 to 2012, when I really started to get a statewide name in child abuse cases, there'd be times where I lived in the center of the state. I might have cases in the south part of the state and then have to schlep all the way to the north part of the state. There's no time for me to go to my office, right? So if I didn't, you know, have something accessible where I could access files and actually learn files as I'm getting retained on cases, I wouldn't be able to handle anywhere near as much volume as I did. So back then we used Dropbox. My office still uses Dropbox to a lesser degree. Mm-hmm. But back then my secretary would scan all the documents. She would use a scanner. We now use ScanSnap.
Sure.
But she would scan the documents and categorize them, index them, and put them into Dropbox for me. So wherever I went, I had my iPad, and I could access Dropbox online, and I would pull up documents. So if I'd go to court in the morning and I was sitting and waiting, I was reading files for the case I got retained on without my having seen the client for the last month, going to meet them for the first time in the afternoon. I was reading their files at lunch or, you know, in the first court appearance wait time. You know, because I didn't have time to get the physical file. And so I'd have weeks where I wouldn't go into my office, not because I was off, you know, at the beach, but because I just couldn't physically get to the office. And the iPad was great for that.
And you could not have developed a statewide practice any other way, because it's not, you couldn't be carrying around legal boxes of files and all over, you know, New Jersey.
Well, I could. It just wore me out.
Well, and it wouldn't be nearly as efficient or nearly as productive in the long run. So as a result of all of this, and you've built up this tremendous practice, this tremendous reputation, you started to share that knowledge and the reasons for your success with other folks in a coaching business you alluded to earlier. Tell us a little bit how that came about and where you are with that.
Yeah. So my coaching business is called The Law Firm Mentor. And I created the Law Firm Mentor earlier this year, really out of a desire to help lawyers do what I did, but in their own way. And what I mean by that is, you know, I had been a client of a coaching service. I was with How to Manage for about 3 years. I started October 2014. I left August of 2017. And I had other business coaches during that time period as well. And what I found was that, you know, you were kind of given a model. It was cookie cutter. You know, we go down this checklist, we troubleshoot problems as they arise. And as my business started to grow, I mean, How to Manage was a great company for me, but, you know, as my business grew, I needed diversity in what problems I was solving. I needed, you know, to leave the checklist formula once I got to a certain size. And I just didn't find that they were helpful to me for that. So I started looking for other options. And still, every time I would encounter a different business coach, they had their way. And their way was always tailored to what they wanted to accomplish. So there are guys out there that are like, if you want the virtual law firm where you never have to go into a brick and mortar, hire me. Or if you want to have 4,000 staff members and a really big structure, hire me. Or if you want to change your practice area and just do one type of practice instead of multiple practice areas, hire me. And I don't adopt that philosophy. My view really is that people can grow as fast or as slow as they want to in the course of business. And if you force them into something before they are ready to step into that direction, even if what they want is really not clear to them, they might be successful at it, but they're not going to be happy at it. And once you arrive at that place of having created something that you don't enjoy, it's more difficult to dismantle it than it was to create it in the first place, because now you've got people's jobs on the line and you've got clients that you've serviced. So I really like the idea of people being able to say, you know, I'm not really certain on what I want. So that's where you really focus your time and energy from an interpersonal perspective, helping them get clear on what they want. But in the meantime, if they're not making enough money and they don't have enough time to enjoy their life, you can start fixing that right away, manically or slowly, depending on the rate of the person, and help them evolve into the person they need to be to grow the law firm that they want, really just by doing some very mild tweaks in business. Perfect example, I have a client right now who came to me. She has a family law practice, and she was reporting that she didn't have enough time to get through to the business stuff because she was stuck in the weeds of the practice. So, you know, we need to hire for this person. We're working on creating a hiring model for her now, and she's in the process. But before she hired, I said, we got to get you some immediate relief. Let's look at how you're calendaring your day. What are you doing? And what I found was that she was just doing things whenever they could fit into the calendar. And I said, okay, that's chaos. You can't shift from thing to thing to thing to thing to thing and think that you're going to be effective. You need your mind to be focused when your mind is on a task. So we have to now create blocks of time for you to get your schedule under control. And it will feel uncomfortable and you will want to go return an email while you're working on a document, and you're not going to do that. And just in a matter of 2 weeks, imposing on her a structure for her calendar got her probably an extra 5 hours each week of billable time. Well, 5 hours at $400 an hour is $2,000. You know, an extra $4,000 over a 2-week time period, pretty easy to see how you can start to move the needle, because now you have cash on hand. So when you hire that person, you're not urgently concerned about how you're going to pay them. You've got cash in the bank. And that was nothing other than an administrative efficiency solution. So before she even got to saying, I want another X dollars a year, or I want to practice in this area versus that area, we were immediately able to get her some money and some time saved.
Yeah. Well, it sounds fascinating. How does the relationship manifest itself between coach and client? Are you doing weekly calls, or, you know, weekly emails, or is it a closed Facebook group, or face-to-face, or quarterly conferences, or just how does your coaching practice manifest itself?
So there are a variety of different services that we have. At the foundational level, I have a course called More Money, More Free Time. And More Money, More Free Time is really about the business basics, how to handle marketing, sales, people, processes, facilities, and money in business. So that's one item. The second item is that we have quarterly retreats, and we call these retreats intensives, and they're focused on one area. So I have an intensive coming up November 10th and 11th of 2018. That is a 2-day all-intense marketing retreat where we do nothing other than teach you how to build marketing funnels, optimize them, put a budget to them, put projections on them, and write them into a plan that works for your business. And all of the intensives are encapsulated around with coaching calls on either side of them, so we can help you start thinking about what's going on in your business and tailor a solution to you. And then you come to the group activity where everyone is going to be doing the same thing specific to their law firm, but you're going to be hearing what other entrepreneurs are doing so that you can take some of that away for yourself and ultimately do what's necessary for you to be successful. And then finally, I have private coaching on top of it. And private coaching, it's a 6-month commitment to start the process. But what we do is we do 2 Zoom calls a month. We start with a diagnostic of your business. Where are you now? And then we do your goal setting, which is where are you going and how can I help you get there? And then we start with every 2 weeks getting on a call, a Zoom meeting, where we can actually create for you a plan for what you need to do between now and the next call. Because what I see a lot of lawyers doing that becomes problematic, and why they often blame coaches, is that, you know, the coach says, hey, you need to go do XYZ, and the person just doesn't get it done. And the person is overwhelmed, they're busy practicing law, they don't have enough time in life and in law, let alone to add something else, and the coach doesn't help them make time and space to be able to get that done. The coach just says, I'm going to hold you accountable and I'm going to make you do it. And then they end up feeling guilty and they often become frustrated with the coach.
Yeah, so, it's just ends up being another big project on my task list.
Right, a project and a big expense. So they see it as an expense and not an investment. And where I try to be different in that regard is I try to, you know, first of all, everybody gets the Real Talent Hiring Assessment on themselves when they start working with me so that they can understand and I can understand what their shortcomings are. So we can be looking out for that. And then we create free space for you by virtue of putting things in place for your schedule so that you can start to take away some of the things that are not serving you and start to fill in with some of the necessities of building out your business, whether it's building out your hiring plan or changing your marketing or increasing your leads. But whatever we do it with an eye of taking things away as we're adding things in so that you're not just overwhelmed, but you're actually steadily making progress toward a goal.
Well, Allison, it sounds fascinating, both in terms of your coaching business and the success of your law firm. I'm delighted that you were able to take a few minutes and out of what is obviously a busy schedule and share them with us today. Tell our audience how they can reach out to you if they want to follow up or be a part of your world.
Okay. Well, thank you again so much, Neil, for having me on the show. I've really enjoyed talking to you about this, and I hope that your audience has gotten some value out of what I've shared. In terms of me, if you want to follow me, I am the Law Firm Mentor. I am on all of the major social media platforms. So I have a YouTube channel. I have a Facebook page. I have an Instagram page. And then, of course, we tweet. So you can find me at facebook.com/lawfirmmentor. No spaces, no dashes. And on Facebook, we also have a closed community, the Law Firm Mentor Movement. So if you want to get access to the Law Firm Mentor Movement, just join, send a request to join the group. You have to answer a couple questions. We want lawyers only and people that are interested in business of law. But you can get that through a bit.ly. So bit.ly/group LFMM. And that is how you would access our group.
Perfect.
And then please do follow me on Facebook. You know, I post tips and tricks all the time, conferences that people should be attending, little strategies that they can start to see improvement in their business. And the More Money, More Free Time free webinar is 90 minutes of teaching content, unlike a lot of webinars that are really just a sales pitch with some tips and tricks along the way. This is actually substantive content. So you can get that on the Facebook page or in the group. But please do take some time to listen to it. It gives you some value right away.
Awesome. That sounds great. Well, again, Allison, thanks ever so much for being with us today on The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you, Neil. Have a great day.
Once again, I'd like to thank our friends at Market Circle, the makers of Daylight and Spotlight Branding, for being sponsors of today's podcast. Market Circles, as the makers of Daylight, provide the tool that I use to manage my cases, my clients, my calendar, my to-dos, emails, and they do so all in one app that stays with me on my Mac, my iPhone, and my iPad. I use Daylight on my own in a solo environment, but you can also use it in a team. You can use Daylight to track the status of cases and delegate tasks to one another on your team, and you can see everyone's schedule all without having to interrupt anyone. Daylight is one of the tools that I use to stay organized, and it increases my efficiency. And therefore, it only stands to reason that it'll do the same for you and your team if you use it in a broader environment. So visit marketcircle.com/daylight to try Daylight free for 30 days. And be sure to let them know that you heard about Daylight through The Law Entrepreneur in order to get a 50% discount on your first monthly subscription. Also, our friends at Spotlight Branding, as always, have been very helpful in sponsoring this podcast. You know, I trust them to manage the internet presence for my law firm, and I recommend them to solo lawyers every chance I get. They built a great website for me, and they use video marketing, social media, email marketing, and more to help keep me top of mind with my referral network. So visit www.spotlightbranding.com to learn more. They're even offering a free gift for podcast listeners, which you can access at spotlightbranding.com/TLE, as in The Law Entrepreneur. So spotlightbranding.com/TLE to access your free gift. And as always, make sure that you visit our website, www.thelawentrepreneur.com, to see everything that's going on with the podcast and subscribe to our newsletter so that you can stay in the know and be the first on your block, so to speak, to gain insight into what's going on here. So once again, thanks for being here this time around. I appreciate your listenership. Hope to see you again next week on The Law Entrepreneur.